This is Where We Live.
All the president has to do is pick up the phone and the bridge is approved.
If the president had wanted to be involved, he would have already
made
that call.
It's his initiative, Linda.
Was his initiative. We're in a trade war now.
Well, that doesn't mean we have to abandon good policy.
It's inconsistent with his current stance.
The Committee on Foreign Investment has 30 days to approve. There's only 6 days left. They won't act without a directive from the President of the United States.
I'm confused. You've been the biggest proponent of a strong position against China.
That is not true. I advocated the opposite early on.
You seem fixated on this bridge. Is something else going on here?
Unemployment is at 9.2. Inflation is skyrocketing. We're on the verge of losing our majority. The president needs to offer a piece of good news.
A bridge? That's a drop in the bucket.
Jobs, infrastructure, deficit reduction. You're still
not being straight with me.
That's Sakina Joffrey as the president's chief of staff sparring with Kevin Spacey as the devious Frank Underwood on the Netflix drama House of Cards. Now, don't worry if you haven't seen season two yet. No spoilers here. But that bridge project that he's fixated on is something we'd be pretty interested in if art was anything like real life. The Port Jefferson Bridge would have connected Long Island to Milford, Connecticut, something I'm sure would be met with local opposition, to say the least. But was something this crazy ever even possible? Well, for about 30 years, various ideas like this kicked around, started by the master New York builder, Robert Moses. Anthony Flint, who's a scholar of Moses' work, says that's only one of the crazy schemes that Moses conceived of but never built. Flint does blame Moses for a series of other huge infrastructure projects that tore up American cities. Today, where we live, big projects that never got built, and some that did. We'll look at the controversial Moses legacy. We'll also consider the proposed Galleria Mall. Remember that New Haven plan for a mall at the junctions of 91 and 95? And what will ever happen to Bridgeport's Steel Point? That's all coming up. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Does the idea of a Port Jefferson bridge to Milford, Connecticut intrigue you, alarm you, excite you? 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live, and you can always follow along at WNPR.org. Joining us by phone is Anthony Flint. He's a fellow and director of public affairs at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. He's author of Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City. He joins us today from Medellin, Colombia, where he's participating in the UN World Urban Forum. Anthony Flint, thank you for making the time, and welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So let's start with this bridge plan. When I started watching House of Cards, they mentioned a Port Jefferson bridge. I wasn't familiar with any plans that had ever been proposed. And then I started looking into it a bit, and this is actually a real idea that dates way back. What can you tell us about the proposal of a bridge that crosses Long Island Sound?
Well, it was late in the master builder's career, and generally known actually as the Rye Oyster Bay Crossing, or that was another label for the idea. And Moses was big on bridges and tunnels and highways through cities. He really shaped the New York City that we know today. Also, of course, parks and playgrounds and all kinds of other good stuff, including Jones Beach. But in 1965, around about 1965, he was pushing a new idea, which would be a crossing across Long Island Sound. Oyster Bay to Rye was one version of it, and this was to sort of add to the bridges that vaulted the Long Island Sound closer to New York City, the Whitestone, the Frog's Neck, and so forth.
Who were the main supporters of this besides Moses? Were people clamoring for this bridge, or was it something that was met with a lot of opposition?
Well, Moses, through his career, was obviously a fascinating figure. He was a swaggering guy on the swim team at Yale, and went to Oxford, and was a very effective political actor. The governor of New York called him the best darn bill drafter in Albany. He was very good at amassing funds, and from his perch at the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, which was his basically his own agency. It had its own fleet of cars and hundreds of employees. He was able to make these proposals pretty much on his own. And of course, that is what has changed so much today. No single actor can sort of try to get things done in such a unilateral fashion.
If you look at the plans that were drawn up for this bridge or some of the other conceived bridges that followed along the same path, do you read them as feasible at all, given the obviously the body of water that would be spanned, the local opposition that would be had even back as far as the 60s, or the enormous cost of such a thing? I mean, in your view, Anthony, is a bridge like that even possible?
It would have been possible. It would have been long. It would have become part of the interstate highway system and extended I-287. It would have been possible from a funding standpoint because it would have been essentially one of the last pieces of to complete the interstate highway system, and this was how Moses was so brilliant. He would, he knew very well that there was this 90% federal funding, from an engineering standpoint, would have been several stanchions essentially in the water, and I believe it would have been the longest span at the time. This is around 1965, 1968, roundabout in that area.
We're talking with Anthony Flint, who's the author of Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City. We're talking about a proposal that Robert Moses floated back as far as the 1950s or 1960s that would build a bridge spanning Long Island Sound. It's something that recently was resurrected for the Netflix show House of Cards as a Port Jefferson to Milford Bridge. We're asking you at 860-275-7266 if you think such a thing is possible or likely, if it's something that you'd like to see. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling from New Haven. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well. What's up?
Well, I actually do watch the show House of Cards, and when I heard him speaking about the bridge, I was like, oh, my gosh, that is a brilliant idea. Because there is a bridge, between New York and Long Island, and it would just be fantastic to have one between Connecticut and Long Island, because I have taken the ferries before. But that would be so much more convenient.
It would be more convenient. I mean, do you think that it would make more traffic in the towns along the shoreline? I mean, what do you think, Sarah, people would think in the towns where, I don't know, a whole bunch of waterfront gets torn up to build a new highway?
That's actually a really good point because at least Milford is a big city, a big town. There's Orange there, and then New Haven's right there too. I think that if it was in another town, it would be way more distractive and cause way more traffic. But also think about tourism. It could very well bring more tourism to the shoreline of Connecticut.
It certainly could. Sarah, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Of course, Anthony, one of the things that Robert Moses did when you talk about building bridges and tunnels, he was perhaps the leader in the American thought at the time that we need to get people in the cars and moving around in corridors. It seems as though the world has changed somewhat. As many people who do want to conveniently drive from one place to another, there's a lot more thought going into public transportation, ways to get cars off the road so they're not creating so much greenhouse gases. Do you think that some of the Moses plans, like a big bridge across the Long Island Sound, do you think it would fare very well in the 2010s?
Well, no, clearly not. It's it is a new era, and you're absolutely right. The focus is on sustainability and transit, very efficient, especially in metropolitan regions like New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey. The big projects that you see now proposed are indeed tunnels for trains, Second Avenue Subway, the proposed ARC tunnel that Governor Chris Christie vetoed a couple of years ago, crossing the Hudson River and speeding up train traffic and commuter traffic. So it's interesting. You see this transition, really, the mega projects are much more likely to be for trains and subways. When Moses was operating, it was a different time. He thought, like a lot of people, that the car was going to sort of symbolize personal mobility in a liberating kind of way, and didn't recognize that when you build a bunch of new lanes, they tend to just fill up, something known now as induced demand. But he was also trying to save New York City in the sense that after World War II, a lot of movement to the suburbs, he was trying to make New York City a place that was easier to get to and easier to get around as an economic development argument. And his argument against congestion, for example, in Lower Manhattan was what led him to propose the Lower Manhattan Expressway, or LOMEX, that would have been a 10-lane elevated highway that would have roared down Broom Street in Soho. And it's, you know, absolutely fantastic to imagine such a thing today when, you know, Soho is some of the most valuable and sort of cherished urban real estate in the country, or indeed the world.
Yeah, with hindsight, a lot of these plans look even crazier than they do right now. Anthony Flint, hang on for one second. I want to bring into the conversation Barbara Maynard. Barbara Maynard is the former first selectwoman of Old Saybrook. One of the proposals to build a bridge across the Sound from Long Island to Connecticut came back in 1979 when Barbara Maynard was Old Saybrook's first selectwoman. Welcome to the show, Barbara. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for asking me.
So maybe you can tell us a bit about this project. This was a bridge that would have gone 8 miles or so across the Sound from East Marion, New York, to Old Saybrook. What was in this plan?
Well, that was a plan that was devised, I believe, by some New York and a New York industrial group, and they thought it was a sound idea, which they were going to put on bumper stickers. However, the area that the bridge was proposed for was the closest point to Long Island, and it happens to be the beautiful shore of Old Saybrook, where the Castle Inn is, and most people know where that is now. It would have wiped out a great deal of our beautiful beach associations down there, Cornfield Point, Knollwood, and our town beach, and provided a upper structure which would go over part of our town and finally land someplace. But we were adamantly opposed to it. We had a 9-town area selectmen's group that opposed it. Our governor, El Grasso, opposed it. It was just not the right place, and it certainly wasn't the right time for us. People in Long Island, I understand, weren't even too happy about putting it way out on that end of the island because it would not do some of the people any good who were closer to New York. So this was a proposal that we immediately turned down. I was appointed to one of the study committees and attended all the meetings and let them know what our feelings were on this. And, you know, this is the Connecticut River estuary region. It's a beautiful river. It's Class B water. And we were very fortunate many, many, many years ago because there were certain sandbars across the mouth of the river which prohibited big boat traffic. So obviously we never had any oil refineries or oil storage tanks like New Haven and Bridgeport and the rest of the big cities because they couldn't get over that sandbar. And that was very fortunate for us because we have a beautiful environment and we take care of it. We have great fishing. We have public parks, and we do not need a bridge. We didn't need it then, and we don't need it now, and I don't think we'd want it now.
You know, we heard a caller earlier who called up from New Haven who said, you know, maybe a bridge across Long Island Sound that goes from Milford across to Long Island wouldn't be such a bad idea. It would allow people to get around easier. At the time, Barbara, was there anyone in your town or in the surrounding towns who was saying, you know, we should really look at this proposal. It could change us. It could bring in tourism. It could help boost our economy.
No, just the opposite. we didn't want more tourism. In the summertime, we are packed full of tourists, which are wonderful people. We have marinas and we have summer cottages and so forth, but we don't have the infrastructure to handle more people. Our tourist trade is very fortunate for us, but we certainly don't need to be the town at the end of the bridge and have all the facilities that would go along with it. I haven't really heard anyone over the years who was in favor of that. I won't say they aren't in favor of it someplace else, but it's not in my backyard.
Not in your backyard. Hang on for a second, Barbara. I want to get to a few phone calls, people who want to join us. Rob is calling from Rye, New York. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi, John. So I grew up in Rye back in the 60s, and I remember very clearly that the community came together and really fought the bridge with petitions and town meetings and campaigning up in Albany. I know that Oyster Bay also fought it. I happen to also currently commute to Long Island three times a week. I bought a Prius to hopefully make my little contribution to the environment. And there's no argument to the fact that convenience, bridge would be extremely convenient, but I think most sensible people recognize that a bridge over Long Island Sound would completely destroy the beauty and, the natural environment, not to mention the community, the coastline towns of places like Rye and straight up the shoreline, either shoreline, with a bridge. A bridge just brings a phenomenal amount of car and even worse, truck traffic.
Rob, before I let you go, one of the things that I find interesting is that in certain cities in America, certain regions like the San Francisco Bay or Seattle or even heading out to Staten Island, there is a ferry culture. There's a culture of getting on the boat and going to work and commuting in that way. Do you ever think that if we had a more elaborate system of boats to get us up and down the shoreline or across to Long Island Sound, that might be an alternative to the car?
Yeah, absolutely. I would do anything. I'd buy a Segway on the other side and fly over to work that way. But the Bridgeport Ferry for us, it's a very long ferry, very long and slow, quite expensive. But I would absolutely consider taking the ferry. It's a great way to kick back. I lived in San Francisco briefly, and I took the ferry back and forth to Sausalito, and it's a great way to decompress, but sitting in a car is just a terrible way to spend a couple hours of your day. Fortunately, I only do it three times a week. I teach out there, and it's only about 9 months a year.
Well, I'll tell you what, in the traffic right now that's in the San Francisco area, taking that ferry across sounds a lot better. Rob, thank you very much for the phone call. Before we take a break, let me go to Senator Ed Meyer, who's calling us. Senator Meyer, of course, represents his constituents down in the Brantford area, and he's long been involved in environmental issues. What's on your mind, Senator?
Oh, John, I just wanted to tell you that in the early 1970s, I was a state legislator in New York when Governor Nelson Rockefeller proposed the bridge that your last caller just referred to is a bridge to come from Oyster Bay in Long Island into Rye in Westchester County in my district. And I was very upset. He told me that it was not just a bridge, but he was going to build something called the Hudson River Expressway from the end of the bridge in Rye right up to the New York Thruway. And I built a coalition of legislators to defeat the bridge and the highway, and he called me into his office and was furious at me. And he said, don't you understand that Robert Moses and I are connecting Long Island with Canada, and you're trying to stop this? And then finally he said to me, if you don't stop your challenge, I'm going to take your house out of your district. And guess what happened? We beat the bridge and the highway, and he took my house out of my district in New York.
You got districted out of your seat, really, because of this?
He told me he was going to do it, and he did it. And I suppose that's one reason I came to Connecticut.
So you ended up in Connecticut just because of that. That's an amazing story. I didn't realize that. So I guess House of Cards and some of the political scheming behind the scenes, it isn't so far-fetched, is it?
Well, Nelson Rockefeller had a lot of vision, and he was a builder. He built the state university system. He built the New York Thruway system. And he was very intent with Robert Moses on building another bridge over Long Island Sound. But the problem was it was going to wipe out hundreds of homes and small businesses. And, you know, in his vision, he missed that. He missed the effect on people.
Well, Senator Meyer, thank you so much for the phone call. I appreciate it.
Good, John. Thanks.
And Anthony Flynn, you just hear one of our state senators talking about that during his time in New York and the political opposition. Anything you want to add to Ed Meyer's story?
Well, it sounds typical of the hardball tactics that Robert Moses employed. I don't want to make him out to be a villain completely, though. I think the thinking is these days it would be great to have a Robert Moses who had a regional vision and knew how to get things done, but for transit and more sustainable transportation and mobility options. But at the time, yeah, you bet. Moses was incredibly adept at twisting arms and making threats or providing rewards. So that sounds about right.
We're talking with Anthony Flint, who's a fellow and director of public affairs at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. He's author of Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City. We'll be back with more from Anthony Flint in just a moment. Take more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. I want to thank Barbara Maynard, former first select woman of Old Saybrook. Good job getting that bridge killed, Barbara, and so good to spend some time with you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, we did have a ferry at one time, you know.
You had a ferry out of Old Saybrook. When did that go away?
Well, it only lasted for about 2 years. It was a small business. A man bought a landing barge, something to get the trucks from the end of Long Island with their fresh fruit and potatoes and so forth over to the Connecticut shore. However, it wasn't financially feasible, and the ferry lasted maybe 12 months, but in the wintertime it wasn't working at all.
Would you support another ferry going out of Old Saybrook across the Sound?
No.
You wouldn't be behind that right now?
No, I would not. We do not have the land to support that sort of thing. We have 17 miles of coastline, all of it very fragile, all of it well protected.
Barbara Maynard, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
When we come back, our conversation continues with another unsuccessful project proposal, the New Haven Galleria Mall. And we want to hear from you. Do you have memories of this plan? Do you think it should have been built, or is the city better off without it? We'll also take more phone calls on a bridge or maybe a tunnel across Long Island Sound. Join us at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about big projects that never got built and some that did. We've been considering the proposal of a bridge across Long Island Sound, the same sort of proposal that got floated in the Netflix series House of Cards. We're talking with Anthony Flynn, fellow and director of public affairs at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. He joins us today from Columbia, where he's participating in the UN World Urban Forum. We're taking some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. In just a moment, we're going to turn our attention to the proposed Galleria Mall that was almost built in New Haven. But first, let's go to Adam, who is calling from West Hartford. Hi, Adam. Go ahead. Good morning.
I guess, you know, I was thinking about this conversation that made me think about the tunnel across the English Channel. And I was wondering, because, you know, the tunnel has not only vehicular traffic, but I think there's also rail. And I was wondering if a tunnel across the Sound would be less invasive to the shoreline on both sides. And I'm not sure if it is. I'm wondering if it is. And how much more expensive it would be than a bridge.
Anthony, great question. So, Anthony Flynn, what do you think about that? I'm wondering whether or not a tunnel version might be a better option if indeed there was a need to connect one part of the world, Long Island, to another, Connecticut, or as Ed Meyer was saying, former Governor Rockefeller, New York, wanting to connect Long Island all the way to Canada through a roadway system. Do you think a tunnel might have made more sense than a bridge?
Well, there was, in my understanding, I think around 2007, there actually was a private proposal for a tunnel making the Long Island crossing, and it would have been, I think initially it was for cars, and then there was a train tube added, and for cars to pay for it, if I recall correctly, there was something like you know, the toll would have been $25 one way. And so that's one way to pay for these mega projects. Now, Tunnel is a great thing the caller brings up. It actually is four trains only. And the reason it works so well, though, is because the rail system between London and Paris is very much in place. And they in Europe, they really take their high-speed rail seriously. They have an Acela that works in Europe and throughout France, and so you can take the train through the tunnel and leave London and be in Paris a pretty short time afterwards. But it has to be part of a network, and of course, just on Long Island, that network would require connecting, I gather, to the Long Island Railroad. So that would be a whole, that would require some serious regional transportation planning.
And a lot more planning probably than we're ready to stomach right now in this region. Let's go to one or two more phone calls quickly. Eleanor is an old line. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi.
Hi, what's up?
Oh, I've been listening to the program this morning, and I was fascinated by it. I was a young child when the Oyster Bay Rye Bridge was proposed, and I heard Senator Edward Meyer talk about the effects on hundreds of people had this happened. And as a child in our family, we were always told basically to work against this proposal. We were wearing the buttons, we had the bumper stickers, we had placards in front of our house. We were young advocates for the environment. It actually taught me to be politically active and to work for the environment. I still do today, and I think this could have been a reason I got so involved in the entire environmental movement. We lived in Oyster Bay, and in Oyster Bay, Long Island, we have this beautiful bay right next to Cold Spring Harbor, also very beautiful, with a trout factory and Teddy Roosevelt summer home and a National Audubon Sanctuary. It's Cold Spring Harbor Biological Labs. All of this would have been wiped out simply with the ramps to the bridge. We were always in fear of the ramps. We were told that the ramps would wipe out our house.
Well, it's quite a story, and we're getting a lot of stories, Eleanor, and I thank you for yours, people who are actually inspired to environmentalism by this project that, you know, honestly, I didn't know very much about, but obviously it played a big role in a lot of shoreline communities. Anthony, before I let you go, I want to ask you just about a few other Robert Moses projects. And as you said earlier, we can't paint the man with just one brush in which all of these projects are car-driven and they're all necessarily evil. But indeed, some of the things that were his ideas did change the face of New York. One that I wanted to ask you about quickly was the Cross Bronx Expressway, the number of people displaced and what we essentially ended up with being nowhere near the kind of utopian vision, I suppose, he had in mind.
Well, that was one of three crosstown expressways. Actually, it was one of four crosstown expressways that he had envisioned, stitching across Manhattan from upper to lower. He wanted to put the Upper Manhattan Expressway around about 125th Street, the Mid Manhattan Expressway around about 34th Street, and then the Lower Manhattan Expressway that we mentioned connecting the Holland Tunnel and the East River Bridges running along Broome Street in Lower Manhattan. The Cross Bronx is the only one that was actually executed. And you look on the map, and it does make a lot of sense. It came at a terrible cost, and he refused to make a few modest realignments that would have spared the relocation of many people. And so that really was a brutal project. Your last caller also brings up this idea of fighting against these ideas, and of course, you know, my book is about Jane Jacobs taking Robert Moses on, and I think helped begin this idea that nobody had to sit back and allow the planners and master builders to control their fate, that they could speak up, that they could bring up environmental concerns particularly, and they could say, no, this is a bad idea. So I think that kind of citizen activism was ended up being quite inspiring, and not only for this, for the New York region, but across the country in San Francisco and Baltimore and Toronto and other places, rising up against these urban freeways. And now the last thing I'll say is that there's a fascinating trend where many communities are dismantling these urban freeways. The Alaskan Way Viaduct, the Embarcadero in San Francisco, the Sheridan Expressway right there in the New York area, and the Claiborne Expressway in New Orleans. And so this is sort of the ultimate testament that these were bad ideas and really ruined a lot of wonderful urban neighborhoods.
Well, as a matter of fact, the next place that we're going to go, the Route 34 connector in New Haven, is being slowly dismantled and built over. And one of the projects we're going to talk about next actually was meant to be a mall hub right between two big highways. I want to let you go, Anthony Flint, and thank you for all your expertise. Anthony Flint is Fellow and Director of Public Affairs at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. If you want to read his book, Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City, you'll learn a lot about this controversial figure in New York history. He joined us today from Columbia, where he's participating in the UN World Urban Forum. Anthony, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So the project that I was talking about, that so-called Galleria Mall, this was a mall project to be built at the intersection of 91 and 95 in New Haven. For all of us who know New Haven right now as a kind of bustling downtown with a lot going on right around Yale University, it seems amazing that this almost got built, but it did. Jeremy Kuttner is a lawyer who graduated from Yale Law School and previously worked as a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He followed this project very, very closely and wrote extensively about it. Jeremy joins us by phone. Welcome to Where We Live, Jeremy.
Thanks so much. Good morning.
Maybe you can give us a little bit of the backstory. How did this mall idea, the Galleria, originally get floated, and when was this?
Yeah, absolutely. So in around, I guess, like the mid-90s, this idea came up for a massive $500 million mega mall to sit at the junction of 95 and 91. And it was really an outgrowth of a lot of the earlier kind of downtown mall projects. For years since the 60s, New Haven had been building and trying to reinvest in downtown mall projects. And then sometime around the mid-90s, the idea sort of sprouted that maybe we can extend the idea of downtown to leap to the other side of the freeway and do something a little more suburban style.
Of course, something that we have to remember for those of us who know the New Haven of today but maybe don't remember the mid-90s, there are a number of downtown department stores that weren't doing so well. A lot of the rebuilding of the city that had been done in the 60s and 70s seemed to leave big gaps in downtown, and so I think people were looking for something to bring jobs, something to bring some vitality to the city, right?
Absolutely. But it did take a lot of people by surprise, because at the same time, New Haven was trying to come up with new proposals to redevelop the Chapel Square Mall, which is sitting right on the New Haven Green. And within the span of a year, the city totally pivoted, and the same developer who was actually in negotiations with the city to redevelop the Chapel Square Mall came up with this idea for the New Haven Galleria to be much larger and much more upscale.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, you can join us to be part of a conversation about the New Haven Galleria Mall or some of the other big projects that maybe didn't get built, maybe shouldn't have gotten built, or maybe should. You can email us where we live at WNPR.org. Alex is in New Haven. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Yeah, so thanks for taking my phone call. I was not in support of the Galleria Mall. I think that you were talking about the Route 34 connector. I don't think that project would have started. I don't think many of the projects that are going on in New Haven that I think that are they're over $2 billion currently in projects underway, those would never have occurred if we had focused on the Galleria Mall. And I think that it was something that the mayor proposed as a way of getting some additional tax revenue. But ultimately, I think that it would have refocused our attention elsewhere. And I think by killing that Galleria Mall and focusing on downtown, we've seen the benefits of that in new construction and in trying to get rid of the 34 connector.
Alex, thank you very much for that. And Jeremy Kuttner, I mean, he makes a very good point, and it's a point sort of in line with some of our other callers on other subjects. It's that a project like this can galvanize a community against it and then begin to focus on something else. Do you believe what Alex is saying, that this proposed mall and its failure actually helped to focus back on downtown New Haven?
Well, absolutely. But it happened with the New Haven Gallery in a very strange kind of way. When the Galleria first started, it was actually fairly popular. And a lot of the downtown opposition came and coalesced because a rival mall developer in Milford decided to oppose the project in a big way. And this is one of the first times that Connecticut had seen kind of large-scale corporate involvement in grassroots efforts. So one of the things that this developer did was start a kind of downtown alliance called the Save Our Downtowns Alliance, where they tried to band together downtown shop owners and people like that to come up with a coordinated effort, and then they helped fund sort of a bunch of lawsuits against the issue. And I think, you know, that took over, but eventually the opinion of other people in the city did coalesce around the idea that this was a huge potential detriment to downtown. And I think a lot of people now in retrospect are saying, well, maybe it was a good thing that it wasn't built, because a lot of the focus was able to stay on downtown, or at least a lot of the focus wasn't taken away from downtown. A lot of money that would have gone to the mall ended up not going there.
Well, one of the things we've talked about at length with Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent, is how John DeStefano, the longtime mayor of the city who just recently stepped aside, actually survived politically his support of the Galleria Mall. This doesn't always happen, Jeremy. When someone gets behind a project that a lot of people don't like, that often sounds a kind of a political death knell, but DeStefano adapted and survived it, didn't he?
Absolutely. When he ran for governor, he called the mall project the biggest mistake of his career. I think one of the savvy things that DeStefano did was throughout the mall development process, he actually kind of spread his bets a little bit. So one of the things that he did was he came up with a proposal to issue bonds for $25 million that would go strictly to downtown. And what was odd about this was that he was basically taking the revenues that the city was going to get from the mall, you know, sitting on the other side of the highway, and kind of dedicate it to downtown development, which, you know, in some ways kind of bypassed the normal budgeting process, but was a way of sort of saying that I do have kind of bets on both sides of the issue, so not everyone could be completely mad at him.
I just want to take a couple quick phone calls as we talk about big projects that never got built. Let's go to Travis, who's calling from Willimantic. Hi, Travis.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's up?
One of the things that really came up in the discussion in terms of some of the projects that Robert Moses did with the Cross Bronx and then all the stuff going through Soho is the function of social class of these neighborhoods and people's ability to oppose these projects and to politically mobilize in order to try to stop these things. And it kind of seemed like from the discussion that, you know, it implied that essentially people after the Cross Bronx realized, oh, hey, we can oppose these things. But there was actually a great deal of opposition within that community. But their ability to mobilize to the extent and make a sort of difference in terms of what these master planners are doing is really hampered by, you know, by their social class.
The suggestion is, and I think you're quite right about this, that a town like Old Saybrook can fight very hard against a bridge that comes into their town because they have a little bit more wealth and are able to band together. Maybe they're able to be listened to a bit more than folks in the Bronx, Travis.
Absolutely.
It's a very interesting point, and I'm very glad you called. Let's get to one more quick phone call before our break. Stan is in New London. Hi, Stan.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's up?
Well, I was calling because I'm listening to the conversation regarding the former bridge and tunnel proposals across the Sound, and our firm is an outfit that has benefited for the lack of the building of a bridge or a tunnel. We operate the ferry out of New London to Orient Point, Long Island, and you know, we've got a fleet of 8 ferries that have, you know, have grown over the years because of the increased traffic between, you know, eastern Long Island and eastern New England. And just from experience, you know, we've spent millions and received state and federal grants over the years, the past 5 to 6 years, to upgrade our fleet to become more environmentally friendly, to meet and exceed EPA Tier 2 standards and even Tier 3 standards for emissions. But however, you know, anytime we look to either add to the fleet or improve our terminal facilities, especially on the Long Island side, you know, we're constantly met with you know, these opposition groups who, you know, many of them are users of the service, but you know, it becomes a quality of life castle between you know, meeting the needs of the economy and the traveling public, who we serve, you know, the demand for, and then those who have to host the particular service, you know, in their backyard, so to speak.
Well, before I let you go, Stan, you raised some really interesting points, and I mentioned to our earlier caller this idea that many parts of our country, and certainly parts of the world, have what I guess I'll call seafaring cultures. I mean, the idea of hopping on a ferry to get around Seattle makes perfect sense. It's something that doesn't really seem, as much as we have water here, doesn't really seem to be as much a part of the culture. Do you think that that's something that if it changed, there would be more people willing to invest in ferries, not try to fight ferries going from town to town? Maybe it's something that could shift over time.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you presented the alternative to a host community of a particular ferry service such as ours, which, you know, is still very bucolic in nature. I mean, the boats are romantic. They're, you know, it's a very, very nice trip. And I think if you surveyed any of our customers, they would tell you the same thing. And even those that oppose any kind of expansion or addition or improvements to our service would probably tell you off the record the same thing. But if you presented them with the alternative, would you rather have a bridge in your backyard, or would you rather have a fleet of 8 ferries running back and forth? They take the ferry any day of the week.
Well, Stan,
because it is consistent with their history of maritime culture.
Stan, thank you very much for your phone call. And when we come back from our break, we're going to talk more about projects that haven't been built yet, but we're going to shift to one in Bridgeport that may still very well be built. I want to thank Jeremy Kuttner first, though, a lawyer who graduated from Yale Law School. He previously worked as a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He's written extensively about the failed Galleria Mall project in New Haven. Jeremy, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
And we'll put more links to these stories on WNPR.org today. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to follow up on a recent conversation we had about heroin use and abuse in Connecticut and the region. We're going to be joined by a panel of reporters and health experts to get an update on not only what's happening in Connecticut, but also Rhode Island and Massachusetts with addiction, recovery, and treatment. A lot of stories around heroin. We're going to follow up tomorrow on Where We Live. I hope you can join us. Since the early 1980s, several attempts have been made to revitalize Bridgeport's Steel Point neighborhood. Here's Mayor Bill Finch, before he was mayor, back in 2006, talking to me about some of the city's redevelopment efforts there.
Okay, the large peninsula you see off to your left here is almost 55 acres. It was taken by eminent domain by the city when we had a developer in hand who wanted to put up a large mall. I personally didn't think a mall was the greatest idea, but, you know, I didn't think the casino was the greatest idea either, but when you're desperate, you'll take what you can get. And we were desperate back in the 80s and the 90s.
Bridgeport residents have been hearing about the potential for a Steel Point Peninsula project since 1983. Here's Bridgeport City Councilwoman Lydia Martinez speaking to WNPR in 2012.
If you asked me 3 years ago, I was disappointed. Nothing was moving. So, you know, then we start questioning. You know, I started questioning it.
Well, we're going to ask some questions right now of Paul Timpanelli. He's President and Chief Executive Officer of Bridgeport's Regional Business Council. So, Paul Timpanelli, welcome to our program. Is Steel Point going to get built?
No question about it. You know, obviously it's been a long time coming, but the stage at which the project now sits is very positive, and we're hopeful that this calendar year, 2014, that there will actually be groundbreaking on the first retail facility that's contracted. So kudos to the mayor and his staff and our legislative delegation and Governor Malloy, because this would not happen without public support.
So explain exactly what this will be. You talk about retail, but this is going to be one of these projects that's going to entail retail and living space. What all is Steel Point going to be when it's built?
Yeah, it's a so-called mixed-use development. In other words, the uses of the 50 acres of real estate are going to be residential, commercial, and otherwise. So along the waterfront, there will be boutique retail, restaurants, boating-related activities, and then on the interior of the site, there'll be residential units, mixed income, some high-rise, some low-rise, and then a component of retail, and then some specialty uses such as a hotel. So the entire 50 acres will be developed with various uses of the real estate. And that makes the project much more appealing, it makes the project much more cohesive, and it fits in with the needs of the city.
Now, we've heard that the first anchor tenant there, the Bass Pro Shops, is set to be built this summer, completed by 2015. Is that still a go? I know that there's been some slowdowns on whether or not Bass Pro Shops was going to get up and running as quickly as we thought.
No, it's very much a go. That project, hopefully the ground will be broken in the next couple of months. All the components of the deal are put together, and the wait currently is the infrastructure construction that's taking place on the site to prepare the site for development and the finalization of the state financing portion.
So here's one of the questions that we've had for a long time about this project, as long as we've been following it. While it seems as though this is an open space that could indeed be a boon to Bridgeport if built up properly, there's always a question of, will it be used? Will people come down there to shop? Will people want to live right there on the Bridgeport Harbor in a place that has not been a residential area for such a long time? What do you know about the reality of this? How many people are clamoring to live there now?
Well, it's the old, if you build it, will they come question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bass Pro Shop is a nationally recognized retail entity that has 53 or 55 locations around the country. They will not build in a location unless they are completely satisfied that the location is marketable, that people will come. So clearly they are convinced that people will come to this waterfront Bridgeport location. The accessibility and visibility from I-95 is perfect, and their appeal is such that they're convinced that there's enough support for this activity to enable them to invest heavily in a city like Bridgeport.
A last thing for you, and this is something that Mayor Bill Finch, he was not mayor at the time that I spoke with him for that NPR story back in 2006, he said that one of the reasons Bridgeport is a place to invest is the possibility of real multimodal transportation. You've got the train right there, but of course you've got a harbor. You can run ferries in and out. There's a lot of ways that you could see Bridgeport as a hub of transit for the entire area. Is that tied into the Steel Point project? Because it seems as though transportation has been a big theme throughout our program today in terms of what projects get built and which projects don't.
Oh, it's absolutely tied in. This clearly is a transportation-related development. The mayor's comments were right on target, and he was absolutely right. As I said, the project itself, meaning the Bass Pro component of the 50 acres, is directly adjacent to I-95, so therefore very, very visible to 125,000 cars a day that drive by that site. It's going to be effectively across the street from the Port Jefferson ferry landing, and currently there are about 1 million passengers a year that go back and forth between Port Jefferson and Bridgeport. They will see the Steel Point development when they get on the ferry. They will see the Steel Point development when they get off the ferry. And it's also two blocks away from the city's train station and its bus terminal. So it's in the center of every transportation nexus that exists in the city of Bridgeport. So it's very, very much related to transportation opportunity.
A last quick thing for you. I know that the land that encompasses this area was bought up by eminent domain over the years. It's laid fairly vacant for a long time. Is there any sense of opposition within the community to the Steel Point project being built? Or is everyone in Bridgeport, from your mind, Paul, really behind this project?
Well, this seems to be one of those things that as rare as it is, has complete community support. I mean, there were times in its history over the last 25 years when there were elements of the community that had questioned the project and there was some opposition. But I think today, in the spring of 2014, I don't recognize any opposition. So, and a lot of credit goes to the developer, because the developer has been loyal and has stuck to this project for a number of years, the current developer. And a lot of credit goes to the mayor and his team for solidifying support around the community. So this project has not been taken for granted. Everyone has done a great job in terms of getting community organizations and community agencies and residents to be supportive of this project. So as rare as it seems, it's to universal support.
And it is rare. Paul Timpanelli is President and Chief Executive Officer of Bridgeport's Regional Business Council. Thank you very much. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks for joining us on Where We Live.